Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Paul Newton, former bass player of Uriah Heep, and before that, The Gods with Ken Hensley. And Paul played on three of the most seminal albums from the Heap catalogue, Very Heavy, Very Humble, Salisbury, and one of my favourites of all time, Look At Yourself. But he's also released a brand new book called Bone Structure, which we're going to be talking about. So welcome, Paul, and thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Phil.
No problem at all. Now, before we come on to your book, I obviously do want to go back in time a little bit because it's absolutely thrilling to actually be talking to somebody whose music has been part of my life for such a long time. Well, I guess the music has been part of your life for a long time as well. But you were there at a point in time in British rock history when a new musical genre was being formed. I mean, I know a lot of people think of heavy metal as being defined by Black Sabbath, but for me personally, I think there was Deep Purple in rock, and in that same year, Very Heavy, Very Humble appeared, which, you know, that marriage of Hammond organ and guitar, I think, you know, both bands were similar in some respects, but I think I remember Mick Box saying the main difference between Uriah Heep and Deep Purple is they had one vocalist and we had five. So what was it when you were making that first album with Uriah Heep? Were you aware that you were making something that all these years later would still be resonating through the years?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the first album, when we started the first album, we were actually still called Spice. We got the deal with Jerry Braun, Braun Artist Management and Vertigo Records at the time. And we'd been in the studio on and off whenever, you know, the schedule allowed it, recorded our songs. And so as we progressed through, you know, doing these recordings, our music started to change a bit. And it became evident we needed some keyboards. So Jerry Braun, our manager, knew a guy called Colin Wood. He was a bit of a jazz pianist. But he got Colin to come along and put keyboards on the necessary tracks. And so that kind of progressed. When it came to the point that we were going to start doing live gigs, then we needed to add a keyboard player to obviously reproduce what we'd recorded.
Yeah.
And we tried a couple of people who were okay keyboard players, but we really needed, we didn't find the right person. And I had previously worked in a band called The Gods with Ken Hensley and Lee Kerslake. And I'd lost contact with Ken for a while, but whilst we were gigging as Spice, I bumped into Ken a couple of times at some gigs. He was playing guitar for Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, and that subsequently became Toe Fat. And we kind of exchanged phone numbers and addresses, and we met up a couple of times with my wife and Ken's wife for an Indian and a social night. And I happened to be talking about the band, the music one night, and Ken said he was a bit fed up with the Cliff Bennett thing. And I said, well, you fancy hooking up with me again? Yeah. I said, well, we're at a point with Spice now. We need a permanent keyboard player. Would you be interested? And to cut a long story short, he came along, met the guys. We got him onto a couple of sessions, and the rest is history, Phil. You know, we had a guy there who played Hammond, played guitar, a good singer, good harmony singer, not a bad lead singer, and was starting to write good songs. So it was pretty well a no-brainer, and it just immediately worked. Later on in the life of the band, it wasn't quite such a smart idea, but I don't really want to go in. After all these years, I don't really want to be going down that road too much. But
no, that's absolutely fine. Because also, I mean, on the first album is a song completely penned by yourself, Dreammare. Was that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we as Spice, myself, David, and Mick, we'd all written songs either together or separately. And that was the one of the ones I came up with after we'd become Uriah Heep. And I was down at my parents in Hampshire late one night. They'd gone to bed, and I got the guitar out, and I was messing around because I had the sort of riff. The intro to Dream Mare was actually part of another song I'd written.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote this song. I've said before, I've all my life I've dreamt, and some dreams are a good dream, some dreams are nightmares. I still do to this day. So it was really a little story about what happened to me when I was asleep sometimes. And I took it along to the guys, and we recorded it, and there we go, it went on the album.
Fantastic. And it's a great song. But the album has got there's still the 60s influence in it, you know, in some songs.
Well, we were still, when we did the first album, it was still what was called progressive rock. I mean, hard rock, heavy rock, metal rock hadn't been invented then. So we were part of the progressive movement with bands like Yes, Jethro Tull. And so that enabled us, I mean, with Spice, we went from being, when I first joined Spice, they were more of a sort of a covers band. And then we became more of a blues band. And then once we started writing our own material, it covered a lot of ground. We still had, Mick was very much a sort of Barney Kessel jazz guitarist. So the first album covered a lot of ground, and it's you can almost, as odd times when I play it now, you can hear the progression from up until things like Gypsy, which became the definitive Uriah Heep sound back then. We realised that's where we wanted to go with that type of music.
Yeah,
and the Hammond organ was, shall I say, instrumental in that, as a pun, but it was the Hammond organ, the block chords, that was just our sound, you know, and it just went from there. Retrospectively, I sometimes listen to very heavy, very humble, and I've got very fond memories of it because I can remember the times we recorded it. We were a good, happy band in those days. I mean, that soon started to dwindle. But that was very, very fond memories of that. And then, of course, we moved on fairly soon after that into doing the Salisbury album, which, again, was still in the progressive days, which is why we could get away with the material that was on it. I mean, you would never get away with that nowadays.
I think Salisbury is a very, very progressive rock album. And again, with the five-part harmonies and the opening song, Bird of Prey, which you were involved in as well, is a perfect example of that. You know, that's a great song.
Yeah, I mean, Salisbury was, it's quite diverse. You had things like The Park, you had Bird of Prey, you had the actual Salisbury Suite. So there's lots of different aspects to the album. And, you know, when it came out, to be honest, it was we received with kind of mixed reviews whenever. And it was never really that well received. Strangely enough, over the last 20 years or so, people have said to me it's their favourite album. And, yeah, people have revisited it and played it and thought, hang on, you know, it's not as bad as the critics said.
I think it's great. And the title track, which obviously is 16 minutes long, it's like a prog classical kind of crossover piece, really. But I think for you personally, because I was playing this, I know it really, really well. But before this interview, I thought, I'm going to play that again because it's one of my favourite tracks. Is when we get about 6 minutes into that song, you basically take over in some ways. So you've got these wonderful, groovy bass lines that basically drive the whole thing along for the next 12 minutes. It's really kind of jazzy playing, or, you know, it's a very prog classical track, but did you I mean, what were your influences back then as a bass player? It's really fantastic.
Yeah, playing. I mean, I have this discussion with many people because it is a fairly jazz-based thing, that the middle section of Salisbury. And it kind of goes back. The first pro band I was in was a band called Shin.
Yeah.
It was named after the keyboard player, Don Shin. He'd be playing with a band called the Soul Agents that at one time had Rod Stewart as the singer or whatever, Southampton bass band. I'd been working with Lee and Ken in the Gods. I subsequently worked with Lee and Ken. Yeah. I'd been semi-pro up until that time. I got together with Don Shin, and I used to go down to a club. He knew the landlord of a club in Southampton, the Concord Club. And I would go down very often on a Sunday afternoon when the club wasn't open. And we would just go there all day and jam. It was in the days of Jimmy McGriff, all Brian Auger, all the great keyboard players. Don was an absolute magician on the Hammond, and he could play all the bass pedals where you need the bass player. So Don grounded me in playing bass with a jazz feel, and sadly he died a few months ago. But I'm always very grateful. Don was a mentor. Without Don Shin, we might not be having this discussion, because he took a young 17-year-old bass player under his wing, and taught me how to play jazz, which I fell into straight away. I loved it. So unfortunately, Shin, it lasted 6 months. The drummer with the band was a guy called Brian Davidson. He got an offer to join Keith Emerson in the Nice, pre-ELP band. So he went, and really Keith Emerson took a lot of Don Shin's ideas and effects with him. But yeah, that was music. We were a bit ahead of our time. So Ken Hensley, whilst I was working with Shin, we did a gig at the Greenford Starlight Ballroom in Greenford. And the guy that managed it also managed the Gods. And the Gods had just split up. And a few weeks later, Shin split up. So my father, who managed Shin, got together with this guy, said, "You fancy reforming the Gods with Ken Hensley, who I'd never really heard of." And it went from there. It was just me and Ken reformed the band. We needed a drummer and guitarist, and I'd known Lee Kerslake from my semi-pro days in Bournemouth. So I got Lee on. Lee was a great singer and a great drummer. We tried a couple of guitarists until we eventually got Joe Konas, who now lives in Canada. And the Gods were a great band. You know, it was a pre-Uriah Heep, really.
We
did the harmonies. We did all the stuff that Heep subsequently took further. So that's basically the history of that. I left the Gods at some point. There's various reasons I left. I went to this is when I met Mick and Dave. I got a job with Spice in London, so went to play with them, and then eventually Ken and Lee, Ken and myself got together, and Heap, and we're back to where we started.
Because Salisbury was such a progression from Very Every Very Humble, especially the title track, because it was so different to the more kind of simplistic riff driven stuff like Gypsy. I mean, did you play that all in one go, or was it put together in pieces?
Yeah, I mean, Salisbury was basically three separate songs that we joined together to make the Salisbury Suite.
Right.
And then Jerry Braun had the bright idea of putting the orchestra on, because Deep Purple had done the Purple in
Yeah, the concerto, yeah.
It wasn't totally my cup of tea, because we played Salisbury live, and we always did with my time in the band. We played it live without the orchestra. But, yeah, they put the orchestra on, and I guess it added some different colours, whatever, to it. But there are some old recordings of Salisbury, you know, without the orchestra. And it worked. That's how it worked, because it was pretty much... Salisbury was the type of thing, when we went into the middle section, it was just a bit of a jam. So myself and probably the rest of the guys, we probably never played it the same every night because, yeah. If you had a great sound, everybody was up for it, you'd have a good blow. If there was a bad sound or somebody had a headache, then it was purely a mood thing, which is what music is about.
Yeah.
So if you played everything perfectly every night, you'd think, well, okay, we've done it. And of course, being so long, as I say, you would never get away with that in today's market. Things have changed, and everything changes. It's evolution. But back in the prog days, we could go on and play that for 20 minutes sometimes, and you get all the long-haired people. Nice. You know, it was just a groove.
Cool.
And it was... You know, we'd done this jamming stuff or whatever in Spice, so we'd always been in for a bit of freeform. But as we became, I guess, more successful and did more recording, whatever, we had to tighten things up and make it sellable. You know, that's a marketing thing from record companies. You know,
so absolutely.
That's how that happened. But no, Salisbury. Again, when I listen to it sometimes now, I think, Crikey, that wasn't that bad, actually, because it's, as we all know, when you've done something, been involved in something yourself, you listen to, or read things differently as to an outsider. So when I have discussions over the years with people about the stuff I did or he have done, you sometimes think, oh, I never thought of that. So you go back and listen to it.
Well, yeah, because I guess it's like people, myself, it's like listening to you realise it just sounds like, well, the bass player's having the time of his life on that track. You know,
I mean, people have said to me over the years, oh, wow, your bass playing on that is... I mean, I'm no great music. I'm the first one to say, Phil, I'm no great. I don't read music or anything. I'm purely a field player. I try and play what's right for the song. And, I mean, what I did in Salisbury... Yeah, listening to it, I'm quite pleased with it. But if you're a good bass player, that's what you do. You go out and play bass, whatever the song is.
So very, very true.
And that's how I don't slap myself on the back. You know, I went out and did what I felt was right for the song.
That's brilliant, of course. And then the next one that comes along, which I know is your favourite from your time in Uriah Heep, is Look At Yourself, which is absolutely
The Look At Yourself album... I mean, I think it's evident if you listen to the three albums, by the time we did Look At Yourself, we knew where we were going. And we had more say in the recording process because Jerry Braun, he gave us the break. But Jerry was always focused on, he banished Manfred Mann and Simon Dupree and people. He was far more 4-minute single, commercially minded. But so we always struggled to do these longer tracks because that's what we did. But Look At Yourself, we actually had more input into the recorded sound, the finished product. So Look At Yourself, I just did the three albums of the band, but that was the pinnacle. And I mean, I think I'm probably biased here for any Uriah Heep album ever. July Morning, which was just, whoever did it, was just a mega song. I mean, I've subsequently played that over the years with Lee and Ken and John Lawton, you know, when they're all around. And I always say to people to go and play July Morning somewhere in Finland or Germany or the States at a big festival with the sun shining and the Hammond organ just soaring out.
Yeah.
Just an absolutely... always brought goosebumps to me. I mean, Ken wrote a classic song there. That's up with Stairway to Heaven. It's just a great song.
It's great, isn't it? Because it has that kind of comparison. Some people, it's a bit like Child in Time by Deep Purple.
Yes, it just hits the spot.
It does,
But I always say to people, it has to be played as it was recorded. You cannot better it. And I mean, various... versions of Uriah Heep and cover bands, they rearrange it. They think, well, people are fed up with hearing. There's certain songs you need to play as they were written, comfortably numb. If I went to see Floyd and Gilmore had totally revamped Comfortably Numb, I'd be distraught.
when July Morning was written, though, it didn't come together straight away, did it? It was
July morning. Ken brought the basics of the song to rehearsal once, and we couldn't really make. He just played it on acoustic guitar. So what used to happen, every so often, we'd have block rehearsals, we're going out on tour or something. So we had block rehearsal, and somebody would say, oh, let's have a go at July morning. So we get out of the box again and muck about with it. And I remember we were rehearsing at a place in Covent Garden sometime, and we got it out. And I had the idea from Child in Time, I guess. I just started doing the boom, 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 on the bass.
Yeah, yeah.
And it kind of, that set it off. And then we very quickly turned it into a song, into an actual proper song. But I say we've had various goes at it that just haven't worked. But I think this is common for, certainly for Uriah Heep and many bands. You have these.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not going to work. We'll do something else. And one day you might wake up in the middle of the night, wow, I got it. And you go off and rehearse it. And there we go. It's on the album.
Fantastic. Now, you left the band after this album.
I got fired from the band. I left the band. Various reasons for that, Phil. Jerry Ken, who I'd got into the band, became, during the recording of Salisbury, towards the end of Salisbury, Ken was becoming heavily involved in various forms of drugs, narcotics or whatever.
Yeah.
Ken had never been the easiest person to work with, but I accepted that. I'd known Ken longer than all the other guys. But Ken became, I think partly because of the drugs and partly because of the way Ken is, Ken became very, very difficult and wanted to spend less. He almost divorced himself from being a band member. He was in the band, but he didn't want to travel with us. And he'd formed an alliance with Jerry Braun. And basically what happened, Jerry Braun and Ken Hensley hijacked our band. Braun realised Ken was right. We're right, probably better songs than the rest of us. During that time, Ken firstly wanted to get rid of Mick, then he wanted to get rid of Dave. Ken thrives, sadly, and I've worked with Ken over, up until his death.
Yeah.
But that's how Ken is, and Ken thrives on unrest. He's a very difficult guy to work with because he's never at peace with himself. He's never at peace with anything. That's how he operates. But being on the road during 1971, we worked virtually every day of the year, either touring or recording, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was just exhausted. We were all exhausted. But I had a young, my wife and I, we had a young son. So I had some, I had a young family at home. I was just constantly tired. Ken was just being so difficult. David was starting, the drink was starting to get a hold of David. So I was on the road in a 5-piece band. It's like being married in a band. With each other all the time. And there was two guys there. One was a drunk and one was a drug, becoming a drug addict. And that's hard work, really hard work. And the tensions within the band and everything just got to be eventually. And I had actually earlier in the year seen the manager who said, I wanted to leave. It's when Keith Baker was in the band and Keith did leave, but they persuaded me to stay on. But it got to the point, it's just too much. I'd had it off. Did my head in, and I collapsed one night on stage, and that was it. I mean, Uriah Heep pretty well all the time. Braun was there. If anybody was ill and couldn't do shows, they were fired. Trevor Boldy years ago. I mean, Trevor said when he was in the band with Ken, he said he grew. He said Ken was always trying to get somebody fired. He thrives on unrest and dissent. I don't know why.
Yeah, because in a way, even looking in from the outside as a fan, it felt like that even I could see, you know, being a youngster back then, that, you know, the record label were working this band so hard. You're doing two albums a year. I mean, after you left, they were it kind of like you just turned everything up to 11. So you've got two albums a year, plus you're constant touring. Then more of the members, Gary Thayne, got involved in drugs. It seemed to just go through the whole band. It must have been a very toxic environment.
It is. I mean, I think it's common in the rock industry or showbiz, but certainly the rock industry. When you're working like that, day after day, day after day, you're tired from traveling. It's all people always outsiders think, you know, used to say, "Oh, what a great life!" You know, you're in the States or in Germany. You do, I just say, but it's work. All we see is airports, buses, hotel rooms, just to do a 2-hour show each night. And the thing is, Phil, you get a lot of time hanging around in hotel rooms or dressing rooms, and then people seek, yeah, we're away from home, so people start having a few drinks or a smoke, and very easily, certainly with the narcotics part of it, you always have people around who will sell you this stuff. And so you're vulnerable. And if you take all those options, this is why we lost Gary Thayne, we lost Dave Byron. You know, we lose people, always have done. Some people survive it and come out of it. Others learn to live with it. And others fall by the wayside and die, which is very sad.
But yeah. When you walked away, you must have thought, well, that's that, and I'll go on to other things. But through your life, you've remained connected to Uriah Heep. I mean, you were in the Hensley Lawton band as well, weren't you? It was about 2003, was it?
Yeah, well basically, when I left the band, I was called up to the office on the pretext of a band meeting. And I got to the office and I'd seen Ken Hensley slinking off down Oxford Street. I got into Jerry Braun's office and he just basically said, "Paul, we've decided to replace you. There's 2 weeks' wages here, 40 quid, which is what we got paid at the time. That's it." And he did the same to Ian Clark, who was the drummer at the time, although I didn't know he'd be fired at the time. So I walked out of the office, Phil. I never, ever saw anybody from Uriah Heep ever again for 30 years.
Wow.
No contact, nothing at all. I went on and did other things. I had the remnants of an American work permit still intact. I did a bit of work in the States. And then I came back, did a few gigs locally with a couple of bands in London. Eventually took a job with a Resolute band, a Palais band for Mecca Ballrooms, which was good money. And I wasn't traveling. I just worked, first of all, in Ilford, the Cat's Whiskers in Ilford. Then the band was moved up to York, and I worked with them up in York for about 4 years. Wow. So I was still playing. I could maintain a home life. You got a couple of nights off each week. And it wasn't, yeah, we played everything from Strict Tempo Waltzes, Quick Steps to cut the covers in the charts. But I was playing, I was earning good money, and I had a life, because I'd realised after Uriah Heep, I didn't actually enjoy touring, long tours. I mean, I get travel sick on coaches and whatever, yeah. Okay, and planes. It wasn't a lifestyle that would ever have, even if I'd not been fired, Phil, I would probably have left sometime in that time, because it wasn't the way. I have other things in my life. I didn't have 100% commitment to doing that. That's a failing in me. So it was circumstances at that time. And so I did this stuff with other people. When we were going into the 80s or late 70s, because I was also doing a bit of studio work, sessions and things, but we were going in, we'd gone through the punk era, and then the electronic music came in. And, of course, people then could get all the bass on synthesizers and stuff. And I was starting to – I was getting pretty fed up with the music biz, because you just get ripped off all the time. I mean, the music business, as I said in that book, it is full of crook liars and whatever. So I trained as a surveyor at Salisbury Tech when I was a youngster before going pro. My dad worked in construction, and it wasn't a conscious change. I was hanging about doing nothing. My dad phoned me up and said, Paul, company I'm working for is looking for surveyors, whatever, if you fancy. And I said, anyway, and that's how I got back into it. And I worked in construction then until I retired in 2015. And my connection with Heap came about reconnection. It must have been late 1999, but I was living in Malvern in Worcestershire. I took a phone call one night from a guy called John Lawton. I'd never met John spoken to him. I asked John from Uriah Heep. And to cut a long story short, he got in contact with Ken, who was living and working for a music company in St. Louis in the States at the time. He'd been offered to, he'd been interested to do a Heep venture in London. And John said, "Are you interested in taking part?" And I've got to be honest, I said at first, "Oh, with Hensley, I'm not sure." But anyway, John talked me into it. We sorted that set up. I had to learn, I had to relearn everything I'd ever played because I'd played it for 30
years. Yeah, of course, yeah.
That's a lot of stuff from subsequent albums that they'd done. Anyway, I sat down and routined all this stuff. We had 3 days rehearsal up in Islington in London and did this show. And, you know, it was okay. Ken had got some finance for it, but of course, as it was typical with Ken, nobody got paid for anything because that's how Ken is. I mean, Ken always say to people say, "Oh, Ken was a great bloke." I said, "Yeah, he was a talented guy, but Ken was a lemon squeezer." I mean, Ken would rip anybody off, and that's it. You just had to accept that with him. You know, he would befriend people, and once he borrowed all their money and used their cars and stuff, then he'd throw them away. That's just the kind of guy he was. He could help it, but Phil. So anyway, we did this show up in North London. The Heap Venture was very well attended. We had a great sound. We had some great backlines and a great PA. And a couple of weeks afterwards, John phoned me up. He said, "Listen, do you fancy taking this band on the road?" He said, "Ken, go out as the Hensley Lawton band." And I said, "No, not really, John." I said, I don't think being on the road with Ken would work for me. So they carried on. They did it with John Lawton's band, Gun Hill, whatever.
Right.
It only lasted a short time because Ken, again, was taking the lion's share of everything. John and the guys were driving the van, setting all the kit up, and Ken would come up in a taxi, whatever. So, yeah, and you can't work like that. It's an unequal balance. So
Did you then play with them again at the Czech Republic in 2019 when you were on stage with me?
Prior to that, we did that show in 2000, and subsequently we did many Heap Ventures in Scandinavia, Germany, Belgium. Oh, I mean, just two or three times a year sometimes, if that. Because John Lawton, as well as John, Lee Kerslake, he'd left Heap by then because of a health problem. So Lee came on board. So we went out as Uriah Heap legends. And of course, for a lot of the punters, you had myself, John, Ken and Lee, you had four ex-Uriah Heap guys. So we were kind of more authentic than the current Mick Box Uriah Heap. But that's beside the point. So we did these shows and things. And then Lee was suffering from, I mean, Lee was so overweight and unfit. So he couldn't do them anymore. I did do one with just me and Ken. And then it basically, we had one booked in Finland for 2021 or whatever, and then the COVID lockdown business knocked all that on the head. And sadly, during lockdown, as we all know, Lee, John Lawton, and Ken all passed away. So that's the end. You can't have a heap. Heap legends with one X-Men member. So that was that. And just before lockdown, 2019, I got a call from Mickey Box because we've sort of remained in contact for the last few years through various things, with BMG Records, all the various marketing things. We were kind of curators for the Uriah Heep pack catalogue, me and Mick. And he just sent me a mail. He said, listen, we're doing the Masters of Rock Festival in Czech Republic. And the promoter said, do we actually bring in some of the ex-members? So he said, I thought of you. So me and I went over there, myself and John Lawton went. Lee was scheduled to come, but by then he was far too ill. So we went on and played to 50,000 people in Czech Republic, which was, for me, that was the first time I'd set foot on stage with Mick Boxton night since the day I left.
Wow.
And we had fun. We had a good crack over there. Lovely. So, yeah.
Finally, on this section, on because Ken Hensley became a born again Christian in the 2000s. Did that not soften him in any way? He didn't change his hood.
No, not really. I mean, but not as far as I'm concerned. He used to travel with a Bible and occasionally spout off to people about it. But I mean, no disrespect for, I know Ken too well. I mean, there wasn't a lot of religion in Ken. He might have sometimes late at night tried to repent for stuff he'd done. But I'm not trying to slag the guy. Well, I probably am, but Ken, I'm not slagging him off. But Ken was a very complex, difficult guy. Nobody ever got to know Ken, really. He had very few people he could call close friends. He was just he was isolated in the Ken Hensley world. I mean, Ken had no concept of, I mean, Ken couldn't change a light bulb or change a plug. He couldn't do anything apart from make music. And that's how he was.
Yeah.
But he was the born again Christian stuff. He always had a religious line on the bottom of his email or whatever. And maybe somewhere in there he did have some faith. But I never actually found any evidence of it, because Ken would always rip somebody off somewhere along the line if he felt it would better him. Ken, I mean, I always say to people when they talk about Ken's religion, I said, well, Ken used to take the church collection, they said, and he would throw all the money up in the air. And what stayed up, God kept, and what came down, Ken kept. And that's just how it is, you know. Anybody who knew Ken well, you would treat Ken with the caution you'd apply to a wild animal. You know, you could never let your guard down.
Yeah. Okay, right. I'm going to go over now to this.
You're going to have to edit a lot of this.
bone structure, your new book. Because when I got it, because I hadn't looked into the background of this book, I was expecting it to be an autobiography, but obviously, but it's not. But there again, it kind of has hints of it. It's a storybook. It's a novel, but it's a very unusual one.
I could just butt in this.
Yeah, of course, please do. How did this come about?
This book came about over the years when I've done heat-related things. We go out and tell anecdotes and tales, historical and whatever. And people always said to me, Paul, as I said in the book, you should write a book. Yeah, but I'm not a writer. And it only happened, I mean, all this is in the foreword of the book. But when we went into the second lockdown, I thought, oh, God, you know, how long is this going to go on for? Because during the first lockdown, I'd redecorated the house, I'd done everything in the house or whatever possible. And I thought, I need something to become involved in. And I went into my office one day and I thought, I don't know, I thought perhaps I can, I'll have a go at writing this book that people have been on about. So I sat down on the old laptop, I was banging things out. And I don't like that. And eventually I came upon the I thought, because what I didn't want to do, Phil, I was only in Uriah Heep for a short time. So I couldn't write a book about that time. And there's so many books out there. I've got bookshelves of them, of the Uriah Heep history. And there's nothing else I could add to that. And I thought, well, what about if I make it, you know, a fictional story, but based on a lot of things that happened in my life, because then I could juggle. It gives me poetic justice, like a bit of maneuverability, and I'm not going to get sued by people for who don't like what I said, you know, because you have to bear these things in mind. And it just went from there. I got off to a few false starts. It started to flow. And I've always read the Bill Bryson books. I don't know if you read any Bill Bryson. Yeah. He'll find a subject, then go off on a bit of a tangent. And so I did that. And to be honest, the only reason I started to write the book and actually eventually completed it was it was a self-indulgent exercise for me. I said to my wife, if I can get this thing finished and get somebody to print me a few copies off, up there with my albums, I can have a book with my name on. And that was the only purpose for me doing it. When I finished, a couple of people that I knew had written books, they gave me a contact for three well-known publishers and a couple of others. But the three well-known publishers all eventually came back offering me a contract, which sounds great. But when I got to the bottom line, I had a contract, but they all wanted several thousand pounds up front to cover costs. So they weren't taking any risks, were they? And I thought, well, you know, that would be pointless because this book, if I sell 200 or 300 copies, I'll be lucky. So I'm not going to spend several thousand pounds down the drain because they probably take my money and then do nothing. And I found a printer. I went to Malvern to get some things printed at Aspect Printers. And while I was in there, I saw some bumps on the table say, we print, you know, whatever number of copies, if you've written a book, we can print it. So I had a meeting with them, and I said, well, I just want, you know, a couple of dozen copies of this book. And they said, well, we can publish it for you if you want. It's only going to cost you, you know, minimal cost, not thousands at all. You know, you've got to register it, whatever. So that's what happened. And it came out. But I did warn people on, you know, through Facebook, social media, whatever, you know, when it came out. I said, this is not a Uriah Heep anthology. It is a fictional story based on my life. So I didn't want to lead people astray. You know, it was a personal thing for me. And if somebody's bought it and enjoys it, so be it. If somebody contacts me, say, Paul, that book's a load of crap. Well, fine, because we all have different tastes. I'm not going to be upset. I send it out to various people, and then you contacted me. But I'm not going to be upset. If you say to me, now, Paul, I've read your book, but I don't really like it. Well, fine, that's, you know, people give me books. I read books, some I like, some I don't like. It's a personal thing.
I think it's very clever because it's like a modern drama that always starts with the present day and then all of a sudden, fast editing, it says 1969 and then it comes back to the present day and then it's 1975. But what I really like is when it suddenly jumps out and you go into this like observational bit. And I think there's lots of people of a certain age will go, oh yeah. And there's a section about real ale and restaurants, which I think a lot of people will identify with.
The restaurant thing, but I mean the real ale thing, I mean, because virtually everything I write about in this book is true, it's happened. And I have these friends, we go away, we've done trips all over the world, lance trips, and one of the guys has got a house in Appledore. But one guy, Alan, is a real ale freak. And so that's what I thought, I'll put Alan in here because this is what you get with real ale people. But I have said to some people have said to me, oh, it's a bit exaggeration, your book. I say, well,
no.
A little bit of poetic license. I said, but everything in that book, my childhood, the incident when I was at school, my father's religious rants, they're absolutely 100% true.
Yeah, because that's
what I said. You couldn't make that up.
Yeah, because as I was reading it, I thought some of this is absolutely got to be really true. And then the bit about the chapter called Pills, about going to the doctor and having your blood pressure taken and all that kind of stuff. Loads of us have been through that.
But I think, if I say any man over the age of 55 has probably been through that. You know, because some people don't take the option, but we've all done it. Yeah. And that is pretty well, when I went to see the doctor, especially because I smoke and drink, you never tell them the truth,
No, you don't. One of my favourite bits is dads and toilet breaks on long journeys. Because that's just like my dad was.
Yeah. But I say everything in there, believe it or not, I mean, there are some things the way I wrote it as I did, it was the only thing that concerned me was the jump in the times from the past to the present back. But it was the only way I felt I could make the book work to keep people's interest. If I just tried chronologically, I think I'd have run out of steam, or people would run out of. I mean, I don't know. That's how I chose to write.
Now, right. I think it works well. For me.
It works for me, Phil. It's funny. Somebody said about it the other night, and I got the book out and I read a couple of chapters. And I thought, shit, I wrote this book, but it's making me laugh. The other thing that makes me laugh, I mean, because I did all the editing, proof, I did everything myself, because otherwise you've got to pay people God knows how much.
Yeah.
And I spent as long doing all that as I did writing it. And reading through the book now, there's still typos and things in there I've missed. And I go, oh, God. But they're not major. I can't change it. So it is. It's a bit like the first Led Zeppelin album. There was all sorts of mistakes on there that they just never bothered to.
Yeah, believe. No.
It's kind of an honest appraisal of my slightly haphazard life, I guess. So.
I love the bit on B&Bs in the 70s with no one with long hair allowed in here and that kind of stuff, because I remember that.
Oh, no, I mean, again, that is totally true. We used to have all sorts of hassles with things. Well, that's how it was back in the day, and that's why I said people go on about diversity and prejudice and that. It's always been there,
Yeah, and open mic nights.
that is one of my... I never get involved. I've always been invited to do these things, I did years and years ago. I did a couple, and they were awful. It's just not my cup of tea. Because, as I say, that I'm a rock bassist, so I don't do that stuff. There would be no point in me. I don't play mandolin or acoustic guitar or whatever. So
yeah.
My experience of open mic nights, and it's just my personal opinion. It doesn't work for me. It works for many people. And I appreciate it gives many musicians, unknown musicians, a little bit of exposure.
Yeah.
It works for them, fine. But don't invite me, that's all.
I mean, throughout the book of Bone Structure's recording career, the record label called BAM, I mean, that could be any record label, but I mean, what was some of that taken from Bronze Records?
Yes. I mean, again, being a fictional book, if I'd written a fictional book and named Braun Artist Management, I mean, somebody would have sued me, or I couldn't have told the truth. So it's that part, with the management company and the business thing, it was based, of course, all that is not true because it's fictional, but it was based really on how all that went, and not just with me and the band subsequently, because Bron, did form an airline, used all the various artist monies to finance it, and then went bankrupt, and all of us lost a shed full of money.
So it's
based on facts, but I couldn't actually make that. I couldn't do it factually. I couldn't mention Braun or whatever because I'd have been in court.
No. And I also like the chapter on dentists because I can relate to that as well.
Well, yeah, and that always amazed me. You're lying back in the chair and the dentist proceeds to... I know it's to try and put your ease, but how can you have a conversation with the man when he's working...
When you're upside down, yeah. But the other thing, there's a couple of things I want to touch on. This is how you kind of, it's a fictional tale, but real life comes into it, where you say, there's one part in the book where you say, oh, I'm listening to one of my favorite albums of all time, Look at Yourself by Uriah Heep.
Well, I thought, if it, because there are a lot of Uriah Heep fans have bought this, and I wanted to try maintain a little bit of a Lincoln reality in there.
Yeah.
For their sake, really, Phil, not so much for mine. And it fitted in okay. And that's why very often I'll say something, I was very humbled or whatever. It is just, it is reinforcing the link that it is me from Uriah Heep writing the book, I guess.
But almost, but talking about them in the third person, when there's a bit, Las Vegas, chapter 16, when it says, oh, and Heap, people like ourselves, I'd formed in 1969, both bands appeal to similar audiences, because there you are in Los Angeles, you know, too. And it's actually talking about them as if they're someone you know, but actually, obviously, you were in it. So it's quite a very clever way of talking about it.
Well, it was the only way I could actually. Because I spoke to Mick, you know, when I was writing the book, I said, Mick, I'm writing this silly book. It's basically, it's a fictional book, but are you okay if I mention, you know, Uriah Heep and you guys in there? I said, because there's little sections of the book I would like to do with that. And he said, no problem. Because it's funny, he said, Paul, funny enough, he said, I've been thinking on very similar lines to writing the book as yourself. He said, there's so much about Heap. He said, I was thinking of trying to do something like that, you know, something based on his life. And he's got far more in his life musically than me. But he said, to make it a bit different to all the anthologies that are out there. So, I just felt that it was. There was times in there when I felt it was right just to mention, you know, Uriah Heep through the eyes of this Paul Watson guy.
And for this, as you say, the character in the book, what was it like playing at weddings? Because that's another.
I mean, it's something about stop doing weddings some time ago. But I mean, as youngsters, as semi-pro guys, we used to do these things. I did work for a band some years ago, just a local band, and we were basically did all the 60s, all the three, we were just a three-piece band. We did all the harmony vocals and all the searcher stuff and all that. So we used to do weddings, but I don't like going to weddings and funerals full stop. That's just me. Because weddings normally turn out sort of families always start arguing at weddings when they've had too much to drink. So, I mean, okay. My first wife and her family always did that. But I just don't enjoy them. You get dressed up and go to these things where you normally, unless they're very good friends, you don't hardly know anybody. So they have to be endured. And playing at them is very similar to how I describe, because why people book a band for a wedding, I don't know, because, you know, their family get-togethers. Everybody gets drunk, they just want to bop around to Jive Bunny. So, you know, I've always said to people, I think they've only booked just to look after the kids.
And I think the most surreal section for me in the book is, it's towards the end of the book, when you talk about the legends were drawing on a lot of interest in this, was ex-members of Heap, Ken Hensley, keyboards, Lee Kerslake, John Lawton, bassist Paul Newton, which is obviously you. Lead guitarist Phil Baker. And then he goes on and says, oh, Paul Newton wandered out with a beer and we started chatting, two bass players together, and I told him, and I thought, you're talking about meeting yourself and having a beer with yourself.
You can see what a strange mind I've got.
Yeah.
But you see, Paul Watson isn't myself. He's the bass player with Bone Structure. I just thought it was a little bit of, again, a link with the band and a little bit of humour in there. I don't know. I've written the book. I kind of understand it because it came out of my mind. But I mean, a lot of people won't like it. I accept that. You've got to be. It probably wouldn't. I mean, people in Germany and the States have bought it. Whether they would get the humour, I don't know. And certainly, people who don't. Yeah, if this don't speak you know, English that well, they wouldn't get it. But that's how it is, you know.
It's highly recommended. Everybody who's watching this and listening, it's really, really good. I really enjoyed it. Fact, fiction, and the face. It really is good. So, where's the best place for people to buy it from?
I did again on my Facebook page. It can be purchased on Amazon, but certainly in this country, if anybody wants to buy it, they can buy it directly from the publisher, Aspect Publishing.
Okay.
If they get it from Amazon, Amazon will probably just direct, as Amazon do, they will just direct to Aspect Publishing. I don't know if it's on Amazon in the States yet. It should be. And I've also warned people, because of Brexit now, there will be local, like in Germany, these people who bought it, they've had to pay €7 tax, because that's not our government, that's what the European government decided to do. But then, someone like Finland, if they've got to pay €7 or €8 tax, that's the price of one pint of beer, or probably less. So I have warned people. I don't want anybody to be misled on this. I warned people it is a fictional story based on my life. I've told them where they can get it if they want. I did send a few copies out personally to people such as yourself or friends, and people are still asking me, but it's not viable to do it. I mean, for me to send a book to the States, which markets for 12 to 13 quid, it costs me the same again in postage.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So there's only so far I can go with it. So basically, if somebody wants it, they will have to buy it, but it can be the ISBN number and everything is all on my Facebook page, so that's where they can get the information.
Okay, well, I'll also put all that information in the description, and I'll put it on the website.
It's all on there. But I said the best place is just direct to the publisher.
Yeah. Okay.
Of course, on Amazon, people can use PayPal or whatever. I mean, because the publisher said, do you want to be sending some yourself? I said, well, I don't do PayPal, so people can't pay me. I mean, I've done things from the past. And people send me dollars or whatever. But I mean, it's money. Yeah. But I didn't want to get into all that, you know.
No, that's understandable. So are you doing anything musically at the moment, or?
What I do musically now, I don't do a lot now, Phil. I was quite busy up until before lockdown with two bands I worked with, but the lockdown really saw the demise of that, and a lot of the gigs, the place we used to play, obviously for financial reasons, don't have bands anymore.
Yeah, true.
So I just do, I do gigs sometimes. Some of my friends live in this area, Malvern. They have a band called The Ferrets. It's only a three-piece band. And if Steve, their bass player, can't do I deck if Steve can't do it. So I've got one coming up next week with them. And I do... every year I do a local thing in Upton on Severn with these guys, the Upton Blues Festival. We do three or four shows there. I occasionally do a guest appearance with Circle of Hands, a Heat tribute band.
Oh, yeah.
Last year I went with Phil Baker, who played guitar in Heat Legends. We went over with Russell Gilbrook from the current Uriah Heat drummer. And we've a couple of other guys, Finnish guys, and we did some gigs in Finland.
Oh, that's cool.
I do things like that. But my days of loading the car up and going to the local pub, the Royal Oak, and playing to 12 people who want high silver lining, and that doesn't float my boat, I'm afraid. Just do set things now that I want to do,
Yeah.
And no open mics, I'm afraid.
Yeah. fully understand. Well, that's the book, Bone Structure by Paul Newton. It's out now. Thank you so much for all your time tonight, Paul. I really, really appreciate it.
Pleasure. I hope I don't. I always tend to get too garrulous in these things. I talk too much.
No, not at all.
I don't like all, at all, but No, I it's been very enjoyable and very nice to have met you, not face to face, but nearly face to face.
Yes, almost, almost. Well, thanks very much, and I'll see you very, very soon. Thank you. So thank you so much for tuning in, and a huge thank you to my guest, Paul Newton, former bass player with Uriah Heep. Wow, to talk to somebody who actually played on July Morning from the album Look at Yourself. Absolutely fantastic. So thank you, Paul, for all your time. And remember, if you can, to seek out Paul's book, Bone Structure, which is a fantastic read. It's funny. It's full of lots of inside information. And it's, as I say, it's very observational, but it's a great story about, you know, rock music from the late 60s right through to the present day. And as Paul said, lots of it is based on truth, but which bits, you have to read the book to find out. So please check out the Now Spinning magazine website at nowspinning.co.uk. Click to subscribe. Join us on YouTube, on social media. Join the Facebook private members group as well. Please subscribe to the podcast, and I shall see you on my next episode.